and upon the earth the grass seemed to grow less green. Every minute, as the train sped on, the colors of things became dingier. The fields were grown parched and yellow, the landscape hideous and bare. And along with the thickening smoke, they began to notice another circumstance, a strange, pungent odor. They were not sure that it was unpleasant, this odor. Some might have called it sickening, but their taste in odors was not developed, and they were only sure that it was curious. Now, sitting in the trolley car, they realized that they were on their way to the home of it, that they had traveled all the way from Lithuania to it. It was now no longer something far off and faint that you caught in whiffs. You could literally taste it as well as smell it. You could take hold of it almost and examine it at your leisure. They were divided in their opinions about it. It was an elemental odor, raw and crude. It was rich, almost rancid, sensual and strong. There were some who drank it in as if it were an intoxicant. There were others who put their handkerchiefs to their faces. The new emigrants were still tasting it, lost in wonder, when suddenly the car came to a halt, and the door was flung open, and a voice shouted, "Stockyards!" They were left standing upon the corner, staring. Down a side street, there were two rows of brick houses, and between them a vista. Half a dozen chimneys, tall as the tallest of buildings, touching the very sky, and leaping from them half a dozen columns of smoke, thick, oily, and black as night. It might have come from the center of the world, this smoke where the fires of the ages still smolder. It came as if self-imperiled, driving all before it, a perpetual explosion. It was inexhaustible. One stared, waiting to see it stop, but still the great streams rolled out. They spread in vast clouds overhead, writhing, curling, then uniting in one giant river. They streamed away down the sky, stretching a black pall as far as the eye could reach. Then the party became aware of another strange thing. This, too, like the odor, was a thing elemental. It was a sound. A sound made up of 10,000 little sounds. You scarcely noticed it at first. It sunk into your consciousness, a vague disturbance, a trouble. It was like the murmuring of the bees in the spring, the whisperings of the forest. It suggested endless activity, the rumblings of a world in motion. It was only by an effort that one could realize that it was made by animals, that it was the distant lowing of 10,000 cattle, the distant grunting of 10,000 swine. They would have liked to follow it up, but alas, they had no time for adventures just then. The policeman on the corner was beginning to watch them, and so, as usual, they started up the street. Scarcely had they gone a block, however, before Jonas was heard to give a cry and began pointing excitedly across the street. Before they could gather the meaning of his breathless ejaculations, he had bounded away, and they saw him enter a shop over which was a sign, J. Shedvilas Delicatessen. When he came out again, it was in company with a very stout gentleman in shirt sleeves and an apron, clasping Jonas by both hands and laughing hilariously. Then Teta Elzbieta recollected suddenly that Shedvilas had been the name of the mythical friend who had made his fortune in America. To find that he had been making it in the delicatessen business was an extraordinary piece of good fortune at this juncture. Though it was well on in the morning, they had not breakfasted, and the children were beginning to whimper. Thus was the happy ending of a woeful voyage. The two families literally fell upon each other's necks, for it had been years since Jokubas Shedvilas had met a man from his part of Lithuania. Before half the day, they were lifelong friends. Jokubas understood all the pitfalls of this new world and could explain all of its mysteries. He could tell them the things they ought to have done in the different emergencies, and what was still more to the point, he could tell them what to do now. He would take them to Pony Anjele, who kept a boarding house the other side of the yards. Old Mrs. Jukniene, he explained, had not what one would call choice accommodations, but they might do for the moment. To this, Teta Elzbieta hastened to respond that nothing could be too cheap to suit them just then, for they were quite terrified over the sums they had had to expend. A very few days of practical experience in this land of high wages had been sufficient to make clear to them the cruel fact that it was also a land of high prices, and that in it the poor man was almost as poor as in any other corner of the earth. And so there vanished in a night all the wonderful dreams of wealth that had been haunting Jurgis. What had made the discovery all the more painful was that they were spending, at American prices, money which they had earned at home rates of wages, and so were really being cheated by the world. The last 2 days they had all but starved themselves. It made them quite sick to pay the prices that the railroad people asked them for food. Yet when they saw the home of the widow Yukniene, they could not but recoil even so. In all their journey, they had seen nothing so bad as this. Pony Anyele had a four-room flat in one of that wilderness of two-story frame tenements that lie back of the yards. There were four such flats in each building, and each of the four was a boarding house for the occupancy of foreigners, Lithuanians, Poles, Slovaks, or Bohemians. Some of these places were kept by private persons, some were cooperative. There would be an average of half a dozen boarders to each room. Sometimes there were 13 or 14 to one room, 50 or 60 to a flat. Each one of the occupants furnished his own accommodations, that is, a mattress and some bedding. The mattresses would be spread upon the floor in rows, and there would be nothing else in the place except a stove. It was by no means unusual for two men to own the same mattress in common, one working by day and using it by night, and the other working at night and using it in the daytime. Very frequently, the lodging housekeeper would rent the same beds to double shifts of men. Mrs. Yukniene was a wizened-up little woman, with a wrinkled face. Her home was unthinkably filthy. You could not enter by the front door at all, owing to the mattresses, and when you tried to go up the back stairs, you found that she had walled up most of the porch with old boards to make a place to keep her chickens. It was a standing jest of the boarders that Anyele cleaned house by letting the chickens loose in the rooms. Undoubtedly, this did keep down the vermin, but it seemed probable, in view of all the circumstances, that the old lady regarded it rather as feeding the chickens than as cleaning the rooms. The truth was that she had definitely given up the idea of cleaning anything. Under pressure of an attack of rheumatism, which had kept her doubled up in one corner of her room for over a week, during which time 11 of her boarders, heavily in her debt, had concluded to try their chances of employment in Kansas City. This was July, and the fields were green. One never saw the fields, nor any green thing whatever, in Packingtown, but one could go out on the road and hobo it, as the men phrased it, and see the country, and have a long rest, and an easy time riding on the freight cars. Such was the home to which the new arrivals were welcomed. There was nothing better to be had. They might not do so well by looking further, for Mrs. Yukniene had at least kept one room for herself and her three little children, and now offered to share this with the women and the girls of the party. They could get bedding at a second-hand store, she explained, and they would not need any while the weather was so hot. Doubtless, they would all sleep on the sidewalk such nights as this, as did nearly all of her guests. "Tomorrow," Jurgis said, when they were left alone, "tomorrow I will get a job, and perhaps Jonas will get one also, and then we can get a place of our own." Later that afternoon, he and Ona went out to take a walk and look about them, to see more of this district, which was to be their home. In back of the yards, the dreary two-story frame houses were scattered farther apart, and there were great spaces bare, that seemingly had been overlooked by the great soar of a city as it spread itself over the surface of the prairie. These bare places were grown up with dingy yellow weeds, hiding innumerable tomato cans. Innumerable children played upon them, chasing one another here and there, screaming and fighting. The most uncanny thing about this neighborhood was the number of the children. You thought there must be a school just out, and it was only after long acquaintance that you were able to realize that there was no school, but that these were the children of the neighborhood. That there were so many children to the block in Packingtown that nowhere in its streets could a horse and buggy move faster than a walk. It could not move faster anyhow on account of the state of the streets. Those through which Jurgis and Ona were walking resembled streets less than they did a miniature topographical map. The roadway was commonly several feet lower than the level of the houses, which were sometimes joined by high boardwalks. There were no pavements. There were mountains and valleys and rivers, gullies and ditches, and great hollows full of stinking green water. In these pools, the children played and rolled about in the mud of the streets. Here and there, one noticed them digging in it after trophies which they had stumbled on. One wondered about this, as also about the swarms of flies which hung about the scene, literally blackening the air in the strange fetid odor which assailed one's nostrils, a ghastly odor of all the dead things of the universe. It impelled the visitor to questions, and then the residents would explain quietly that all this was made land, and that it had been made by using it as a dumping ground for the city garbage. After a few years, the unpleasant effect of this would pass away, it was said. But meantime, in hot weather, and especially when it rained, the flies were apt to be annoying. Was it not unhealthful? The stranger would ask, and the residents would answer, perhaps, but there is no telling. A little way further on, and Jurgis and Ona, staring open-eyed and wondering, came to the place where this made ground was in process of making. Here was a great hole, perhaps two city blocks square, and with long files of garbage wagons creeping into it. The place had an odor for which there are no polite words, and it was sprinkled over with children who raked in it from dawn till dark. Sometimes visitors from the packing houses would wander out to see this dump, and they would stand by and debate as to whether the children were eating the food they got or merely collecting it for the chickens at home. Apparently none of them ever went down to find out. Beyond this dump, there stood a great brick yard with smoking chimneys. First they took out the soil to make bricks, and then they filled it up again with garbage, which seemed to Jurgis and Ona a felicitous arrangement, characteristic of an enterprising country like America. A little way beyond was another great hole, which they had emptied and not yet filled up. This held water, and all summer it stood there, with the nearby soil draining into it, festering and stewing in the sun. And then, when winter came, somebody cut the ice on it and sold it to the people of the city. This, too, seemed to the newcomers an economical arrangement, for they did not read the newspapers, and their heads were not full of troublesome thoughts about germs. They stood there while the sun went down upon the scene, and the sky in the west turned blood red, and the tops of the houses shone like fire. Jurgis and Ona were not thinking of the sunset, however. Their backs were turned to it, and all their thoughts were of Packingtown, which they could see so plainly in the distance. The line of the buildings stood clear-cut and black against the sky. Here and there, out of the mass, rose the great chimneys, with the river of smoke streaming away to the end of the world. It was a study in colors now, this smoke. In the sunset light, it was black and brown and gray and purple. All the sordid suggestions of the place were gone. In the twilight, it was a vision of power. To the two who stood watching while the darkness swallowed it up, it seemed a dream of wonder, with its tale of human energy, of things being done, of employment for thousands upon thousands of men, of opportunity and freedom, of life and love and joy. When they came away, arm in arm, Jurgis was saying, "Tomorrow, I shall go there and get a job." Chapter 3. In his capacity as delicatessen vender, Jacobus Schedvilus had many acquaintances. Among these was one of the special policemen employed by Durham, whose duty it frequently was to pick out men for employment. Jacobus had never tried it, but he expressed the certainty that he could get some of his friends a job through this man. It was agreed, after consultation, that he should make the effort with old Antanas and with Jonas. Jurgis was confident of his ability to get work for himself, unassisted by anyone. As we have said before, he was not mistaken in this. He had gone to Brown's and stood there not more than half an hour before one of the bosses noticed his form towering above the rest and signaled to him. The colloquy, which followed, was brief and to the point. "You speak English?" "No, Lithuanian." Jurgis had studied this word carefully. "Job?" "Yeah," a nod. You worked here before?
No, Stent. Signals and gesticulations on the part of the boss, vigorous shakes of the head by Jurgis.
You shovel guts?
No, Stent. More shakes of the head.
Jarnos, takestes, shluota.
Imitative motions.
Ja. See door?
Duris?
Pointing. Yeah. Tomorrow, 7 o'clock. You understand? Ritoi. Prespietis. Septini.
De qui. Damestai. Thank you, sir. And that was all. Jurgis turned away. And then, in a sudden rush, the full realization of his triumph swept over him. And he gave a yell and a jump and started off on a run. He had a job. He had a job! And he went all the way home as if upon wings and burst into the house like a cyclone to the rage of the numerous lodgers who had just turned in for their daily sleep. Meantime, Jokubus had been to see his friend, the policeman, and received encouragement, so it was a happy party. There being no more to be done that day, the shop was left under the care of Lucia. And her husband sallied forth to show his friends the sights of Packingtown. Jokubus did this with the air of a country gentleman escorting a party of visitors over his estate. He was an old-time resident, and all these wonders had grown up under his eyes, and he had a personal pride in them. The Packers might own the land, but he claimed the landscape, and there was no one to say nay to this. They passed down the busy street that led to the yards. It was still early morning, and everything was at its high tide of activity. A steady stream of employees was pouring through the gate. Employees of the higher sort, at this hour, clerks and stenographers and such. For the women, there were waiting big two-horse wagons, which set off at a gallop as fast as they were filled. In the distance, there was heard again the lowing of the cattle, a sound as of a far-off ocean calling. They followed at this time, as eager as children in sight of a circus menagerie, which, indeed, the scene a good deal resembled. They crossed the railroad tracks, and then on each side of the street were the pens full of cattle. They would have stopped to look, but Jokubus hurried them on, to where there was a stairway in a raised gallery from which everything could be seen. Here they stood, staring, breathless with wonder. There is over a square mile of space in the yards, and more than half of it is occupied by cattle pens. North and south, as far as the eye can reach, there stretches a sea of pens. And they were all filled. So many cattle, no one had ever dreamed existed in the world. Red cattle, black, white, and yellow cattle, old cattle and young cattle. Great bellowing bulls and little calves not an hour born. Meek-eyed milch cows and fierce longhorn Texas steers. The sound of them here was as of all the barnyards of the universe. And as for counting them, it would have taken all day simply to count the pens. Here and there ran long alleys, blocked at intervals by gates, and Jokubus told them that the number of these gates was 25,000. Jokubus had recently been reading a newspaper article which was full of statistics such as that, and he was very proud as he repeated them and made his guests cry out with wonder. Jurgis, too, had a little of this sense of pride. Had he not just gotten a job and become a sharer in all this activity, a cog in this marvelous machine? Here and there about the alleys galloped men upon horseback, booted and carrying long whips. They were very busy, calling to each other and to those who were driving the cattle. They were drovers and stock raisers who had come from far states and brokers and commission merchants and buyers for all the big packing houses. Here and there they would stop to inspect a bunch of cattle, and there would be a parley, brief and businesslike. The buyer would nod or drop his whip, and that would mean a bargain, and he would note it in his little book along with hundreds of others he had made that morning. Then Jokubus pointed out the place where the cattle were driven to be weighed, upon a great scale that would weigh 100,000 pounds at once and record it automatically. It was near to the east entrance that they stood, and all along this east side of the yards ran the railroad tracks, into which the cars were run, loaded with cattle. All night long this had been going on, and now the pens were full. By tonight they would all be empty, and the same thing would be done again. And what will become of all these creatures? cried Teta Elzbieta.
By tonight, Jochebus answered, they will all be killed and cut up, and over there on the other side of the packing houses are more railroad tracks, where the cars come to take them away.
There were 250 miles of track within the yards, their guide went on to tell them. They brought about 10,000 head of cattle every day, and as many hogs and half as many sheep, which meant some 8 or 10 million live creatures turned into food every year. One stood and watched, and little by little caught the drift of the tide as it set in the direction of the packing houses. There were groups of cattle being driven to the chutes, which were roadways about 15 feet wide, raised high above the pens. In these chutes, the stream of animals was continuous. It was quite uncanny to watch them pressing on to their fate, all unsuspicious, a very river of death. Our friends were not poetical, and the sight suggested to them no metaphors of human destiny. They thought only of the wonderful efficiency of it all. The chutes into which the hogs went climbed high up, to the very top of the distant buildings, and Jochebus explained that the hogs went up by the power of their own legs, and then their weight carried them back through all the processes necessary to make them into pork. They don't waste anything here, said the guide, and then he laughed and added a witticism which he was pleased that his unsophisticated friends should take to be his own. They use everything about the hog except the squeal. In front of Brown's general office building, there grows a tiny plot of grass, and this, you may learn, is the only bit of green thing in Packingtown. Likewise, this jest about the hog and his squeal, the stock and trade of all the guides, is the only gleam of humor that you will find there. After they had seen enough of the pens, the party went up the street to the massive buildings which occupy the center of the yards. These buildings, made of brick and stained with innumerable layers of Packingtown smoke, were painted all over with advertising signs from which the visitor realized suddenly that he had come to the home of many of the torments of his life. It was here that they made those products, with the wonders of which they pestered him so, by placards that defaced the landscape when he traveled, and by staring advertisements in the newspapers and magazines, by silly little jingles that he could not get out of his mind, and gaudy pictures that lurked for him around every street corner. Here was where they made Brown's imperial hams and bacon, Brown's dressed beef, Brown's Excelsior sausages. Here was the headquarters of Durham's pure leaf lard, of Durham's breakfast bacon, Durham's canned beef, potted ham, deviled chicken, peerless fertilizer. Entering one of the Durham buildings, they found a number of these visitors waiting, and before long there came a guide to escort them through the place. They made a great feature of showing strangers through the packing plants, for it was a good advertisement, but Ponus Jochebus whispered maliciously that the visitors did not see any more than the packers wanted them to. They climbed a long series of stairways outside of the building to the top of its 5 or 6 stories. Here was the chute, with its river of hogs, all patiently toiling upward. There was a place for them to rest to cool off, and then through another passageway they went into a room from which there is no returning for hogs. It was a long, narrow room, with a gallery along it for visitors. At the head there was a great iron wheel about 20 feet in circumference, with rings here and there along its edge. Upon both sides of this wheel there was a narrow space into which came the hogs at the end of their journey. In the midst of them stood a great burly negro, bare-armed and bare-chested. He was resting for the moment, for the wheel had stopped while men were cleaning up. In a minute or two, however, it began slowly to revolve, and then the men upon each side of it sprang to work. They had chains which they fastened about the leg of the nearest hog, and the other end of the chain they hooked into one of the rings upon the wheel. So as the wheel turned, a hog was suddenly jerked off his feet and borne aloft. At the same instant, the ear was assailed by a most terrifying shriek. The visitors started in alarm. The women turned pale and shrank back. The shriek was followed by another, louder and yet more agonizing. For once started upon that journey, the hog never came back. At the top of the wheel, he was shunted off upon a trolley and went sailing down the room. And meantime another was swung up, and then another, and another, until there was a double line of them, each dangling by a foot and kicking in frenzy, and squealing. The uproar was appalling, perilous to the eardrums. One feared there was too much sound for the room to hold, that the walls must give way or the ceiling crack. There were high squeals and low squeals, grunts and wails of agony. There would come a momentary lull and then a fresh outburst, louder than ever, surging up to a deafening climax. It was too much for some of the visitors. The men would look at each other, laughing nervously, and the women would stand with hands clenched and the blood rushing to their faces and the tears starting in their eyes. Meantime, heedless of all these things, the men upon the floor were going about their work. Neither squeals of hogs nor tears of visitors made any difference to them. One by one they hooked up the hogs, and one by one, with a swift stroke, they slit their throats. There was a long line of hogs, with squeals and lifeblood ebbing away together, until at last each started again and vanished with a splash into a huge vat of boiling water. It was all so very businesslike that one watched it fascinated. It was pork-making by machinery, pork-making by applied mathematics, and yet somehow the most matter-of-fact person could not help thinking of the hogs. They were so innocent. They came so very trustingly. And they were so very human in their protests, and so perfectly within their rights. They had done nothing to deserve it, and it was adding insult to injury, as the thing was done here, swinging them up in this cold-blooded, impersonal way, without a pretense at apology, without the homage of a tear. Now and then a visitor wept, to be sure, but this slaughtering machine ran on, visitors or no visitors. It was like some horrible crime committed in a dungeon, all unseen and unheeded, buried out of sight and of memory. One could not stand and watch very long without becoming philosophical, without beginning to deal in symbols and similes, and to hear the hog squeal of the universe. Was it permitted to believe that there was nowhere upon the earth, or above the earth, a heaven for hogs, where they were requited for all of this suffering? Each one of these hogs was a separate creature. Some were white hogs, some were black, some were brown, some were spotted, and some were old, some were young. Some were long and lean, some were monstrous, and each of them had an individuality of his own, a will of his own, a hope, and a heart's desire. Each was full of self-confidence, of self-importance, and a sense of dignity. And trusting strong in faith, he had gone about his business, and while a black shadow hung over him and a horrid fate waited in his pathway, now suddenly it had swooped upon him and had seized him by the leg. Relentless, remorseless, it was. All his protests, his screams, were nothing to it. It did its cruel will with him, as if his wishes, his feelings, had simply no existence at all. It cut his throat and watched him gasp out his life. And now was one to believe that there was nowhere a god of hogs to whom this hog personality was precious, to whom these hog squeals and agonies had a meaning? Who would take this hog into his arms and comfort him, reward him for his work well done, and show him the meaning of his sacrifice? Perhaps some glimpse of all this was in the thoughts of our humble-minded Jorgis, as he turned to go on with the rest of the party, and muttered, "Dieve, but I'm glad I'm not a hog." The carcass hog was scooped out of the vat by machinery. And then it fell to the second floor, passing on the way through a wonderful machine with numerous scrapers, which adjusted themselves to the size and shape of the animal, and sent it out at the other end with nearly all of its bristles removed. It was then again strung up by machinery, and sent upon another trolley ride, this time passing between two lines of men, who sat upon a raised platform, each doing a certain single thing to the carcass as it came to him. One scraped the outside of a leg, another scraped the inside of the same leg. One with a swift stroke cut the throat, another with two swift strokes severed the head, which fell to the floor and vanished through a hole. Another made a slit down the body, a second opened the body wider, a third with a saw cut the breastbone, a fourth loosened the entrails, a fifth pulled them out, and they also slid through a hole in the floor. There were men to scrape each side and men to scrape the back. There were men to clean the carcass inside, to trim it, and wash it. Looking down this room, one saw, creeping slowly, a line of dangling hogs 100 yards in length, and for every yard there was a man, working as if a demon were after him. At the end of this hog's progress, every inch of the carcass had been gone over several times, and then it was rolled into the chilling room, where it stayed for 24 hours, and where a stranger might lose himself in a forest of freezing hogs. Before the carcass was admitted here, however, it had to pass a government inspector who sat in the doorway and felt of the glands in the neck for tuberculosis. This government inspector did not have the manner of a man who was worked to death. He was apparently not haunted by a fear that the hog might get by him before he had finished his testing. If you were a sociable person, he was quite willing to enter into conversation with you and to explain to you the deadly nature of the ptomaines which are found in tubercular pork. And while he was talking with you, you could hardly be so ungrateful as to notice that a dozen carcasses were passing him untouched. This inspector wore an imposing silver badge, and he gave an atmosphere of authority to the scene, and as it were, put the stamp of official approval upon the things which were done in Durham's. Jorgis went down the line with the rest of the visitors, staring open-mouthed, lost in wonder. He had dressed hogs himself in the forest of Lithuania, but he had never expected to live to see one hog dressed by several hundred men. It was like a wonderful poem to him, and he took it all in guilelessly, even to the conspicuous signs of demanding immaculate cleanliness of the employees. Jorgis was vexed when the cynical Jokobus translated these signs with sarcastic comments, offering to take them to the secret rooms where the spoiled meats went to be doctored. The party descended to the next floor, where the various waste materials were treated. Here came the entrails, to be scraped and washed clean for sausage casings. Men and women worked here in the midst of a sickening stench, which caused the visitors to hasten by gasping. To another room came all the scraps to be tanked, which meant boiling and pumping off the grease to make soap and lard. Below, they took out the refuse, and this, too, was a region in which the visitors did not linger. In still other places, men were engaged in cutting up the carcasses that had been through the chilling rooms. First, there were the splitters, the most expert workmen in the plant, who earned as high as 50 cents an hour and did not a thing all day except chop hogs down the middle. Then there were cleaver men, great giants with muscles of iron. Each had 2 men to attend him, to slide the half carcass in front of him on the table and hold it while he chopped it, and then turn each piece so that he might chop it once more. His cleaver had a blade about 2 feet long, and he never made but 1 cut. He made it so neatly, too, that his implement did not smite through and dull itself. There was just enough force for a perfect cut and no more. So through various yawning holes there slipped to the floor below, to one room, hams, to another, forequarters, to another, sides of pork. One might go down to this floor and see the pickling rooms, where the hams were put into vats, and the great smoke rooms, with their airtight iron doors. In other rooms they prepared salt pork. There were whole cellars full of it, built up in great towers to the ceiling. In yet other rooms, they were putting up meat in boxes and barrels and wrapping hams and bacon in oiled paper, sealing and labeling and sewing them. From the doors of these rooms went men with loaded trucks to the platform where freight cars were waiting to be filled, and one went out there and realized with a start that he had come at last to the ground floor of this enormous building. Then the party went across the street to where they did the killing of beef, where every hour they turned 400 or 500 cattle into meat. Unlike the place they had left, all this work was done on one floor, and instead of there being one line of carcasses which moved to the workmen, there were 15 or 20 lines, and the men moved from one to another of these. This made a scene of intense activity, a picture of human power wonderful to watch. It was all in one great room, like a circus amphitheater, with a gallery for visitors running over the center. Along one side of the room ran a narrow gallery, a few feet from the floor, into which gallery the cattle were driven by men with goads which gave them electric shocks. Once crowded in here, the creatures were prisoned. each in a separate pen, by gates that shut, leaving them no room to turn around, and while they stood bellowing and plunging, over the top of the pen there leaned one of the knockers, armed with a sledgehammer, and watching for a chance to deal a blow. The room echoed with the thuds in quick succession, and the stamping and kicking of the steers. The instant the animal had fallen, the knocker passed on to another, while a second man raised the lever, and the side of the pen was raised, and the animal, still kicking and struggling, slid out to the killing bed. Here a man put shackles about one leg, and pressed another lever, and the body was jerked up into the air. There were 15 or 20 such pens, and it was a matter of only a couple of minutes to knock 15 or 20 cattle and roll them out. Then once more, the gates were opened, and another lot rushed in, and so out of each pen there rolled a steady stream of carcasses, which the men upon the killing beds had to get out of the way. The manner in which they did this was something to be seen and never forgotten. They worked with furious intensity, literally upon the run, at a pace with which there is nothing to be compared except a football game. It was all highly specialized labor, each man having his task to do. Generally, this would consist of only 2 or 3 specific cuts, and he would pass down the line of 15 or 20 carcasses, making these cuts upon each. First there came the butcher, to bleed them. This meant one swift stroke, so swift that you could not see it, only the flash of the knife, and before you could realize it, the man had darted onto the next line, and a stream of bright red was pouring out upon the floor. This floor was half an inch deep with blood, in spite of the best efforts of men who kept shoveling it through the holes. It must have made the floor slippery, but no one could have guessed this by watching the men at work. The carcass hung for a few minutes to bleed. There was no time lost, however, for there were several hanging in each line, and one was always ready. It was let down to the ground, and there came the headsman, whose task it was to sever the head, with 2 or 3 swift strokes. Then came the floorsman to make the first cut in the skin, and then another to finish ripping the skin down the center, and then half a dozen more in swift succession to finish the skinning. After they were through, the carcass was again swung up, and while a man with a stick examined the skin to make sure that it had not been cut, and another rolled it up and tumbled it through one of the inevitable holes in the floor, the beef proceeded on its journey. There were men to cut it, and men to split it, and men to gut it, and scrape it clean inside. There were some with hoses which threw jets of boiling water upon it, and others who removed the feet and added the final touches. In the end, as with the hogs, the finished beef was run into the chilling room to hang its appointed time. The visitors were taken there and shown them, all neatly hung in rows, labeled conspicuously with the tags of the government inspectors, and some which had been killed by a special process marked with the sign of the kosher rabbi, certifying that it was fit for sale to the Orthodox. And then the visitors were taken to the other parts of the building to see what became of each particle of the waste material that had vanished through the floor, and to the pickling rooms, and the salting rooms, the canning rooms, and the packing rooms, where choice meat was prepared for shipping in refrigerator cars, destined to be eaten in all the four corners of civilization. Afterward, they went outside, wandering about among the mazes of buildings in which was done the work auxiliary to this great industry. There was scarcely a thing needed in the business that Durham and Company did not make for themselves. There was a great steam power plant and an electricity plant. There was a barrel factory and a boiler repair shop. There was a building to which the grease was piped and made into soap and lard. And then there was a factory for making lard cans, and another for making soap boxes. There was a building in which the bristles were cleaned and dried for the making of hair cushions and such things. There was a building where the skins were dried and tanned. There was another where heads and feet were made into glue, and another where bones were made into fertilizer. No tiniest particle of organic matter was wasted in Durham's. Out of the horns of the cattle, they made combs, buttons, hairpins, and imitation ivory. Out of the shin bones and other big bones, they cut knife and toothbrush handles and mouthpieces for pipes. Out of the hoofs, they cut hairpins and buttons before they made the rest into glue. From such things as feet, knuckles, hide clippings, and sinews came such strange and unlikely products as gelatin, icing glass, and phosphorus, bone black, shoe blacking, and bone oil. They had curled hair works for the cattle tails, and a wool pullery for the sheepskins. They made pepsin from the stomachs of the pigs, and albumin from the blood, and violin strings from the ill-smelling entrails. When there was nothing else to be done with the thing, they first put it into a tank and got out of it all the tallow and grease, and then they made it into fertilizer. All these industries were gathered into buildings nearby, connected by galleries and railroads with the main establishment, and it was estimated that they had handled nearly a quarter of a billion of animals since the founding of the plant by the elder Durham, a generation and more ago. If you counted with it the other big plants, and they were now really all one, it was, so Jacobus informed them, the greatest aggregation of labor and capital ever gathered in one place. It employed 30,000 men. It supported directly 250,000 people in its neighborhood, and indirectly it supported 500,000. It sent its products to every country in the civilized world, and it furnished the food for no less than 30 million people. To all these things, our friends would listen open-mouthed. It seemed to them impossible of belief that anything so stupendous could have been devised by mortal man. That was why to Jorgis it seemed almost profanity to speak about the place, as did Jacobus, skeptically. It was a thing as tremendous as the universe, the laws and ways of its working no more than the universe to be questioned or understood. All that a mere man could do, it seemed to Jorgis, was to take a thing like this as he found it, and to do as he was told. To be given a place in it, and a share in its wonderful activities, was a blessing to be grateful for, as one was grateful for the sunshine and the rain. Jorgis was even glad that he had not seen the place before meeting with his triumph, for he felt that the size of it would have overwhelmed him. But now he had been admitted, he was a part of it all. He had the feeling that this whole, huge establishment had taken him under its protection and had become responsible for his welfare. So guileless was he, and ignorant of the nature of business, that he did not even realize that he had become an employee of Brown's, and that Brown and Durham were supposed by all the world to be deadly rivals, were even required to be deadly rivals by the law of the land, and ordered to try to ruin each other under penalty of fine and imprisonment. Chapter 4. Promptly at 7 the next morning, Jorgis reported for work. He came to the door that had been pointed out to him, and there he waited for nearly 2 hours. The boss had meant for him to enter, but had not said this, and so it was only when on his way out to hire another man that he came upon Jorgis. He gave him a good cursing, but as Jorgis did not understand a word of it, he did not object. He followed the boss, who showed him where to put his street clothes, and waited while he donned the working clothes he had bought in a second-hand shop and brought with him in a bundle. Then he led him to the killing beds. The work which Jorgis was to do here was very simple, and it took him but a few minutes to learn it. He was provided with a stiff besom, such as is used by street sweepers, and it was his place to follow down the line the man who drew out the smoking entrails from the carcass of the steer. This mass was to be swept into a trap, which was then closed, so that no one might slip into it. As Jorgis came in, the first cattle of the morning were just making their appearance, and so, with scarcely time to look about him, and none to speak to anyone, he fell to work. It was a sweltering day in July, and the place ran with steaming hot blood. One waded in it on the floor. The stench was almost overpowering, but to Jorgis it was nothing. His whole soul was dancing with joy. He was at work at last. He was at work and earning money. All day long he was figuring to himself. He was paid the fabulous sum of 17.5 cents an hour. And as it proved a rush day, and he worked until nearly 7 o'clock in the evening, he went home to the family with the tidings that he had earned more than $1.50 in a single day. At home, also, there was more good news. So much of it at once, that there was quite a celebration in Agnelli's hall bedroom. Jonas had been to have an interview with a special policeman to whom Shedvilas had introduced him, and had been taken to see several of the bosses, with the result that one had promised him a job at the beginning of next week. And then there was Maria Berchinskas, who, fired with jealousy by the success of Jurgis, had set out upon her own responsibility to get a place. Maria had nothing to take with her, save her two brawny arms and the word job, laboriously learned. But with these, she had marched about Packingtown all day, entering every door where there were signs of activity. Out of some, she had been ordered with curses, but Maria was not afraid of man or devil, and asked everyone she saw, visitors and strangers, or work people like herself, and once or twice, even high and lofty office personages, who stared at her as if they thought she was crazy. In the end, however, she had reaped her reward. In one of the smaller plants, she had stumbled upon a room where scores of women and girls were sitting at long tables preparing smoked beef in cans. And wandering through room after room, Maria came at last to the place where the sealed cans were being painted and labeled, and here she had the good fortune to encounter the forelady. Maria did not understand then, as she was destined to understand later, what there was attractive to a forelady about the combination of a face full of boundless good nature and the muscles of a dray horse. But the woman had told her to come the next day, and she would perhaps give her a chance to learn the trade of painting cans. The painting of cans being skilled piecework and paying as much as $2 a day, Maria burst in upon the family with the yell of a Comanche Indian and fell to capering about the room so as to frighten the baby almost into convulsions. Better luck than all this could hardly have been hoped for. There was only one of them left to seek a place. Jurgis was determined that Teta Elzbieta should stay at home to keep house, and that Ona should help her. He would not have Ona working. He was not that sort of a man, he said, and she was not that sort of a woman. It would be a strange thing if a man like him could not support the family, with the help of the board of Jonas and Maria. He would not even hear of letting the children go to work. There were schools here in America for children, Jurgis had heard, to which they could go for nothing. That the priest would object to these schools was something of which he had as yet no idea, and for the present his mind was made up that the children of Teta Elzbieta should have as fair a chance as any other children. The oldest of them, little Stanislovas, was but 13, and small for his age at that, and while the oldest son of Shedvilas was only 12 and had worked for over a year at Jones's, Jurgis would have it that Stanislovas should learn to speak English and grow up to be a skilled man. So there was only old Dede Antanas. Jurgis would have had him rest too, but he was forced to acknowledge that this was not possible, and besides, the old man would not hear it spoken of. It was his whim to insist that he was as lively as any boy. He had come to America as full of hope as the best of them, and now he was the chief problem that worried his son. For everyone that Jurgis spoke to assured him that it was a waste of time to seek employment for the old man in Packingtown. Shedvilas told him that the packers did not even keep the men who had grown old in their own service, to say nothing of taking on new ones. And not only was it the rule here, it was the rule everywhere in America, so far as he knew. To satisfy Jurgis, he had asked the policeman and brought back the message that the thing was not to be thought of. They had not told this to old Anthony, who had consequently spent the 2 days wandering about from one part of the yards to another, and had now come home to hear about the triumph of the others, smiling bravely and saying that it would be his turn another day. Their good luck, they felt, had given them the right to think about a home. And sitting out on the doorstep that summer evening, they held consultation about it, and Jurgis took occasion to broach a weighty subject. Passing down the avenue to work that morning, he had seen two boys leaving an advertisement from house to house, and seeing that there were pictures upon it, Jurgis had asked for one, and had rolled it up and tucked it into his shirt. At noontime, a man with whom he had been talking had read it to him and told him a little about it, with the result that Jurgis had conceived a wild idea. He brought out the placard, which was quite a work of art. It was nearly 2 feet long, printed on calendared paper with a selection of colors so bright that they shone even in the moonlight. The center of the placard was occupied by a house, brilliantly painted, new and dazzling. The roof of it was of a purple hue and trimmed with gold. The house itself was silvery, and the doors and windows red. It was a 2-story building with a porch in front and a very fancy scrollwork around the edges. It was complete in every tiniest detail, even the doorknob, and there was a hammock on the porch and white lace curtains in the windows. Underneath this, in one corner, was a picture of a husband and wife in loving embrace. In the opposite corner was a cradle with fluffy curtains drawn over it, and a smiling cherub hovering upon silver-colored wings. For fear that the significance of all this should be lost, there was a label in Polish, Lithuanian, and German. Dom, namai, chaim. Why pay rent? The linguistic circular went on to demand. Why not own your own home? Do you know that you can buy one for less than your rent? We have built thousands of homes which are now occupied by happy families. So it became eloquent, picturing the blissfulness of married life in a house with nothing to pay. It even quoted, "Home, sweet home," and made bold to translate it into Polish, though for some reason it omitted the Lithuanian of this. Perhaps the translator found it a difficult matter to be sentimental in a language in which a sob is known as a guksiozimus, and a smile as a nushishipsojimus. Over this document, the family pored long, while Ona spelled out its contents. It appeared that this house contained four rooms, besides the basement, and that it might be bought for $1,500, the lot and all. Of this, only $300 had to be paid down, the balance being paid at the rate of $12 a month. These were frightful sums, but then they were in America, where people talked about such without fear. They had learned that they would have to pay a rent of $9 a month for a flat, and there was no way of doing better unless the family of 12 was to exist in one or two rooms as at present. If they paid rent, of course, they might pay forever and be no better off. Whereas if they could only meet the extra expense in the beginning, there would at last come a time when they would not have any rent to pay for the rest of their lives. They figured it up. There was a little left of the money belonging to Teta Elzbieta, and there was a little left to Jurgis. Maria had about $50 pinned up somewhere in her stockings, and Grandfather Anthony had part of the money he had gotten for his farm. If they all combined, they would have enough to make the first payment. And if they had employment, so that they could be sure of the future, it might really prove the best plan. It was, of course, not a thing even to be talked of lightly. It was a thing they would have to sift to the bottom. And yet, on the other hand, if they were going to make the venture, the sooner they did it, the better. For were they not paying rent all the time, and living in a most horrible way besides? Jurgis was used to dirt. There was nothing could scare a man who had been with a railroad gang, where one could gather up the fleas off the floor of the sleeping room by the handful. But that sort of thing would not do for Ona. They must have a better place of some sort very soon. Jurgis said it with all the assurance of a man who had just made $1.57 in a single day. Jurgis was at a loss to understand why, with wages as they were, so many of the people of this district should live the way they did. The next day, Maria went to see her forelady and was told to report the first of the week and learn the business of can painter. Maria went home, singing out loud all the way, and was just in time to join Ona and her stepmother as they were setting out to go and make inquiry concerning the house. That evening the three made their report to the men. The thing was altogether as represented in the circular, or at any rate, so the agent had said. The houses lay to the south about a mile and a half from the yards. They were wonderful bargains. The gentleman had assured them, personally and for their own good. He could do this, so he explained to them, for the reason that he had himself no interest in their sale. He was merely the agent for a company that had built them. These were the last, and the company was going out of business. So if anyone wished to take advantage of this wonderful, no-rent plan, he would have to be very quick. As a matter of fact, there was just a little uncertainty as to whether there was a single house left. For the agent had taken so many people to see them, and for all he knew, the company might have parted with the last. Seeing Tita Elzbieta's evident grief at this news, he added, after some hesitation, that if they really intended to make a purchase, he would send a telephone message at his own expense and have one of the houses kept. So it had finally been arranged, and they were to go and make an inspection the following Sunday morning. That was Thursday. And all the rest of the week, the killing gang at Brown's worked at full pressure, and Jurgis cleared $1.75 every day. That was at the rate of $10.50 a week, or $45 a month. Jurgis was not able to figure, except it was a very simple sum. But Ona was like lightning at such things, and she worked out the problem for the family. Maria and Jonas were each to pay $16 a month board, and the old man insisted that he could do the same as soon as he got a place, which might be any day now. That would make $93. Then Maria and Jonas were between them to take a third share in the house, which would leave only $8 a month for Jurgis to contribute to the payment. So they would have $85 a month, or, supposing that Dede Antanas did not get work at once, $70 a month, which ought surely to be sufficient for the support of a family of 12. An hour before the time on Sunday morning, the entire party set out. They had the address written on a piece of paper, which they showed to someone now and then. It proved to be a long mile and a half, but they walked it, and half an hour or so later, the agent put in an appearance. He was a smooth and florid personage, elegantly dressed, and he spoke their language freely, which gave him a great advantage in dealing with them. He escorted them to the house, which was one of a long row of the typical frame dwellings of the neighborhood, where architecture is a luxury that is dispensed with. Ona's heart sank, for the house was not as it was shown in the picture. The color scheme was different, for one thing, and then it did not seem quite so big. Still, it was freshly painted and made a considerable show. It was all brand new, so the agent told them, but he talked so incessantly that they were quite confused and did not have time to ask many questions. There were all sorts of things they had made up their minds to inquire about, but when the time came, they either forgot them or lacked the courage. The other houses in the row did not seem to be new, and few of them seemed to be occupied. When they ventured to hint at this, the agent's reply was that the purchasers would be moving in shortly. To press the matter would have seemed to be doubting his word, and never in their lives had any one of them ever spoken to a person of the class called gentleman, except with deference and humility. The house had a basement about 2 feet below the street line and a single story about 6 feet above it, reached by a flight of steps. In addition, there was an attic, made by the peak of the roof and having one small window in each end. The street in front of the house was unpaved and unlighted, and the view from it consisted of a few exactly similar houses scattered here and there upon lots grown up with dingy brown weeds. The house inside contained 4 rooms, plastered white. The basement was but a frame, the walls being unplastered, and the floor not laid. The agent explained that the houses were built that way, as the purchasers generally preferred to finish the basements to suit their own taste. The attic was also unfinished. The family had been figuring that in case of an emergency they could rent this attic, but they found there was not even a floor, nothing but joists, and beneath them the lath and plaster of the ceiling below. All of this, however, did not chill their ardor as much as it might have been expected, because of the volubility of the agent. There was no end to the advantages of this house as he set them forth, and he was not silent for an instant. He showed them everything, down to the locks on the doors and the catches on the windows and how to work them. He showed them the sink in the kitchen with running water and a faucet, something which Teta Elzbieta had never in her wildest dreams hoped to possess. After a discovery such as that, it would have seemed ungrateful to find any fault, and so they tried to shut their eyes to other defects. Still, they were peasant people, and they hung on to their money by instinct. It was quite in vain that the agent hinted at promptness. They would see, they told him. They could not decide until they had had more time. And so they went home again, and all day and evening there was figuring and debating. It was an agony to them to have to make up their minds in a matter such as this. They never could agree altogether. There were so many arguments upon each side. And one would be obstinate, and no sooner would the rest have convinced him than it would transpire that his arguments had caused another to waver. Once in the evening, when they were all in harmony and the house was as good as bought, Shedvilas came in and upset them again. Shedvilas had no use for property owning. He told them cruel stories of people who had been done to death in this buying a home swindle. They would be almost sure to get into a tight place and lose all their money, and there was no end of expense that one could never foresee, and the house might be good for nothing from top to bottom. How was a poor man to know? Then, too, they would swindle you with a contract, and how was a poor man to understand anything about a contract? It was all nothing but robbery, and there was no safety but in keeping out of it. And pay rent? Asked Jurgis. Ah, yes, to be sure, the other answered. That, too, was robbery. It was all robbery for a poor man. After half an hour of such depressing conversation, they had their minds quite made up that they had been saved at the brink of a precipice. But then Shedvilas went away, and Jonas, who was a sharp little man, reminded them that the delicatessen business was a failure, according to its proprietor, and that this might account for his pessimistic views, which, of course, reopened the subject. The controlling factor was that they could not stay where they were. They had to go somewhere. And when they gave up the house plan and decided to rent,